Welcome to Season 10, Episode 19 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk about, well, our favorite game. Again, welcome to Season 10, Episode 19 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this episode is Chris. Welcome.
Greetings and salutations.
Yeah, it's, wow, it's been 2 weeks. That seems weird somehow. I don't know why.
Fair enough.
But, we do have a little bit of news that you brought to my attention.
So, something fun and silly, I'm a real fan of the original Expedition of the Barrier Peaks, and apparently they're setting up a GM's Guild, you know, in their monthly online Dragon Plus, and they're basically doing a sequel module to go towards the Barrier Peaks for the charity Extra Life. And, I don't know, I just thought it'd be fun. Just kind of fun they were actually bringing this thing out of the woodshed.
I never knew it was in the woodshed. I thought it was behind the woodshed.
Exactly. Kind of that one thing you don't like admitting in public.
I saw something nasty in the woodshed. Oh, that was Cold Comfort exactly. Farm. Never mind.
Yeah, it was a bunny on a stump.
A bunny on a stump. Well, we'll talk about bunnies later, actually.
Exactly.
But, okay, so...
Well, yeah.
The topic, so, which is just favorite RPGs and kind of why. Since we kind of did what our favorite... Are games that we used to love but no longer love, and why that is. Well, let's talk about what our favorite games are. And I think probably most of our longtime listeners will probably guess most of us ours at some level.
I'll agree completely. Like, we've kind of had our opinion on here. I'm going to try go out of my way to try to pull up some of the ones that I haven't mentioned in the show, but I got a feeling that might be a little bit of an uphill battle.
Well, it's always tough because you can't help but talk about games that you love or games that you like to play a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you know, if nothing else, like, you find that one game that's your bee's knees, and you end up basically going all over the place with it, and then use that as your measuring stick on all of their games.
Well.
And, well, that's part of the fun of gaming, is trying new experiences, new situations here.
I think definitely for me.
Yes, Jeff, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, why not? I'll start off. Which, of course, let's face it. Most people who know me probably will guess that it's Savage Worlds. But, even within Savage Worlds, I have to say my personal favorite has to be the Solomon Kane setting.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I
think it was the safe bet, but at the same time, it's still a really original environment for what it is. Because it takes place, a lot of times finding a really good gaming experience is finding one that really hasn't been done before. And it's an environment that kind of fits between a lot of the more historical ones and the more classical medieval ones, which seems to be, you know, that you're a fan of.
Yeah.
So, I guess, why?
Well, let's be blunt. First off, I like the Savage World mechanics just for general purpose. But even in Solomon Kane, it's not a perfect, you know, they still change some things in Savage Worlds. Primarily, the magic system is sort of like the Savage World core rulebook. So if you have, obviously, the Explorer Edition, the magic system sort of the same, but not really. They actually limit which powers exist and with which realm, if you will.
And,
does that make sense?
Well, realm? When you're trying to build... Oh, it does make perfect sense here. Basically, you're trying to go for a feel, and it best emulates a certain feel when it comes to the limit, you know, basically trying to make the fluff match the crunch.
Yeah. So, I mean, because one of the things they definitely do is they do away with PowerPoints. There's no PowerPoints in the game. So you're not ever expending PowerPoints for the Savage World setting, which is cool. The disadvantage is that all the spells have a spell casting modifier. And so that can be a -1, -2, -3, -4, whatever the case may be. And so one of the things you can do is you can take extra casting time. Each round that you take an extra casting round removes one of the minus one, one of those minus one penalties. So if it's minus two, if you take two rounds to cast it, you can finally cast it, you know, two rounds of prep. On that third round, you can cast it without any penalty. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does, actually. It's basically the more casting you do, the greater penalties you get. Am I understanding that right?
More like the spell itself. The more complex the spell, the longer, the more time you take to cast that spell because of the complexity, the better off you are, the better chances it is to succeed. Because they have a totally separate one penalty for if you want to cast multiple spells at the same time. You get a penalty. You get like
Sounds dangerous.
Well, you get basically you get an action, you know, for like stuff that's sustainable, you know, like armor, you know, that lasts. And then some of the other spells that have durations. For each one of those spells that's active, you get penalties. I think it's, I want to say it's an action penalty. I have to double, I haven't read the read that section of the rules in a while. But it's like an action penalty. So for each one you have up, it's either, I think it's negative two, or it might just be negative one. I want to say it's negative two for each one. So you're not going to have a lot of active spells at the same time going on. And that's definitely that's definitely nice. And they have a few spells that are specific to Solomon Kane, you know, to kind of fill in the feel. But it's nice because there's no damage spells, really. You know, it's like you don't have an attack spell that's like, here's my bolt. No, there's none of that. You know, so there's not the classical fantasy spells. It's very, well, how do you describe that? I don't know how to describe that without, it's very, I don't want to say sedate, but there's very, if you've ever seen like some of the old Hammer horror movies, any magic that might have been in there, that's kind of the feel that you get. I think that
That sounds like actually kind of a fun system.
Yeah.
Like just the sheer feeling of that.
Yeah.
So magic exists, but you're not expecting your wizard to be an artillery peach. It's more of a ritualist.
Yes. I mean, honestly, probably the best spell that most people I've ever played with use is the fear spell. Because that actually has an area effect.
Oh?
Yeah. You know, because it causes people, you know, if you, I think, you know, it can cause people to be shaken or it can cause them to just run. And depending on what's happening, that's usually a very effective spell for people.
Yeah, well,
so
you get a chance to dominate the location by essentially scaring the bejesus out of them in order to control, you know, it's a control spell.
Yeah, so
if you're using fear.
Yeah, and there's some other ones that, you know, there's all kinds of little things that's kind of cool. So there's that. Then there is, you know, one of the things, one of the other things that I like Solomon Kane for is in terms of a setting, you know, because that's the thing. I always tell people it's funny that sometimes you can use the same system, but in different settings, and it doesn't work in different settings. So
that is true.
So when you play a game, sometimes it's not just the game mechanics, it's the game setting. And so for me, Solomon Kane is, you know, both halves of those coin, you know, of that coin. And one of the things I like is, you know, there is some technology, but it's not overpowering. One of the things that, as much as I love science fiction games, you know, I like Traveler, you know, I like, you know, the old Star Frontiers to a certain degree. I like Space Master, you know, I like Traveler 2300 AD, or when it was just, well, that was when it first came out, then it was just 2300, you know.
Yeah.
And some of those other games, it's like, it's great, you know, even Cyberpunk, you know, the old Cyberpunk game. I like those games, but the technology became, you know, at a certain point, technology becomes like the thing. And it's like, you know, I mean, and even, and I think that's my problem with a lot of fantasy games is that magic just becomes the technology that you exploit.
Well, you get I guess the best way I can put it is a toy box mentality.
Right.
Because I own the original Cyberpunk 2020. I like them a lot. I think they're neat books to thumb through. And then you realize they basically fell in love with 35 versions of guns, which three of them you're only actually really going to use.
Well, I mean, you just have to look at all the Chromebooks for Cyberpunk 2020.
Yeah.
The first one, okay.
They are great books to read, but when you bring them up in an actual game context, you start having issues.
Right. So one of the things I like about Solomon Kane is that the tech is there. You know, you have muskets and you have, you know, wheel lock pistols. And it's like, okay, so you actually get some range shooting that you can get done. But then you also, you know, there's a reload time, which you can, there are ways to mitigate the reload time. But, you know, you're only, at best, you're firing one shot around. There's like no real rate of fire weapons, which actually is a plus. You know, there's not a lot of, you know, there's not a lot of area weapons, you know. At best, what you're doing is you're pulling your pistol, shooting it, dropping it, and drawing another pistol and shooting it. That might be faster if you have two pistols. Or in some cases, I've known some people that carry four.
Well, that's the old joke, because you get one shot with it, so you gotta, that's why, you know, when you watch those little pirate movies, they at least have six or seven, just because of emergencies.
Right.
So, because any of them, one of the reasons the sword lasted for such a long time is it never misfired. And honestly, we didn't get consistent firepower until the late 19th century.
Right. And, you know, that was the other nice thing. It's like, they have rules for grenades, but the grenades, the fuses are kind of flaky. So you throw a grenade, it might not go off.
It's actually historically accurate.
Right. You know, it was dangerous to be a grenadier.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Actually, firearms in general for most of, you know, the early times was dangerous, you know. You know, you have those old breech artillery pieces, and people just used to lose, you know, thumbs and hands and shit because, you know, their body parts would get caught in the breech as they're loading the rounds.
Oh, absolutely. And on top of that, you never want to be the engineer with the petard, a.k.a. the spike with a set of explosives on it you got to basically go into the castle walls for.
Right.
You get paid a lot, and if you live through it, you'll make a lot of money, but there's a sticking point that you probably won't live through the experience.
Right. So, anyway, getting back to this. So, you know, and armor exists, but because it's because firearms have become a thing, and they all have, you know, a lot of the firearms have some sort of armor-piercing capability, armor really isn't a thing. So you're kind of in that zone where it's like the players probably won't have armor, and if they do, it's not going to be that effective against firearms. And even if they do have armor, it's not going to be a lot. It's not going to be like, I'm wearing full plate mail, you know, or like in, you know, modern day, you're not wearing like level 4 ballistic plates around, you know?
No.
I can stop at 30-06 round.
Point where we're basically acting as well. Well, there's always going to be the arms weapons race, but there's a reason why we started lighting up our loads is because, well, it wasn't that plate mail didn't work against firearms. In fact, it basically cost you to move from point A to point B and wasn't nearly as effective. But, you know, and it was easier just to build a rock and basically hide behind it.
Yeah. So I'm just saying, you know, so it's nice because it's in that it's in this weird technological sweet spot that I like, you know, and because magic isn't a major thing, you combine those together and it's like you have like, you know, you have an environment where players can do stuff, and just by skill alone, they don't have to be magic users. They don't have to be heavily armed to be able to do things, you know, I mean, armored to be able to fight things. And that's nice to me. You had a question.
Indeed. Jeff, what century does Solomon Kane take place in? It's been a while.
I believe the 17th.
Okay, that almost lines up perfectly for another concept. There is a video game I've been wanting to make into a system, and I think you may have found the perfect system for it. So well done. There's this weird video game called Sangfroid Tales of Werewolf. I may have mentioned it before. The premise is right out of Solomon Kane. Imagine a pair of, it's Quebec, 19th century, so it might be a little later, where two feuding brothers have to put aside their differences to save their sister, who's pursued by the devil. And literally, you're out in the middle of the back 40 trying to survive. It's kind of a tower defense game, but in this way, it would actually make more sense to be, it sounds like almost the pitch-perfect scenario for Solomon Kane and the Inquisitors to show up in town, because it's a very Catholic location. Yeah. You know, the Inquisitors come in to stop this great dark pact that may or may not be happening. And then you basically have to figure out how to, well, rectify the situation here.
Yeah. And, you know, so here comes another strength that I think for Solomon Kane. While they do have a plot point campaign in the book that I've run a few times, it's nice because at least the plot point campaign, you start off and they need to find all these special relics. But it's like, all, you know, the only thing that the players know initially is like, well, these, you know, there's two, you know, there's, you know, basically they find out there's two in the Americas. There's like some in Africa and in Asia and in Europe. You decide which way you're going to go.
They got a world tour.
Right. Well, and it's like the players have to decide, well, where do we want to start? Do we want to just start in Europe since we're here? Or do we want to go to Asia, you know, or do we want to go to Africa? Which is, so, mm-hmm. I mean, they go around to various locations. And if you have the supplement, there's an adventure supplement. I forget how many actual adventures, you know, because most of their adventures are maybe a page, page and a half, 2 pages max. And it's like, they have something ridiculous, like 50-something adventures, I think. I think I counted once around all the locations. Wow. And so it's like...
That sounds pretty amazing.
You know, so... And that's... I mean, just in the basic book, I think there's like 30-some-odd. And I think the other supplement adds another 30 or something. I forgot. I counted once. And it's just... To me, it's insane because they actually... I think the adventure book, I think it's called The Path of Solomon Kane... That has like an adventure that even takes place in Japan, if you want to get that far.
Oh, wow.
So
I mean,
it's like...
Definitely a different and a half.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely they take you on a world tour if you're willing to. That said, even if you don't do the plot point campaign as written, those are mm-hmm. all these adventures, just weird stuff that happens. I mean, it's almost like... it's a combination of Doctor Who and Scooby-Doo, where you arrive somewhere and you just get involved. You know?
Yeah, you basically get stuck in a political or supernatural event that you end up in there kind of in the situation.
Right. And I mean, they have an adventure where, while I don't think you never really engage Dracula directly, you actually run into Dracula. The only note that they have in the adventure is the fact that the players cannot defeat Dracula. His demise is destined at a later date and time. they actually write that in the adventure, you know. Instead,
called the deadline syndrome, where you're afraid to set your characters because they're going to kill him.
Well, you know, but I mean, he just kind of shows up. You know, the brides show up because I think the players mm-hmm. get to defeat the brides, and I think like some werewolves. I'm not with some werewolves, but some wolves and stuff show up, and he kind of just scoffs at you and leaves. You know, kind of thing. You know.
Oh, man, that's hilarious. So basically you get dissed by one of the greatest evils on the planet.
Yeah,
that's
pretty
awesome.
Pretty much. I mean, granted, he can cause problems for you later. I'm sure he can, you know. And that's actually even one of the other adventures that where you're in India, you go up against some thuggies. And, you know, when you defeat the thuggies, you know, the note is that later on they will come after you. For defeat, you know.
He never answered the power of a dangling villain.
You know, so, it, you know, all the adventures... Are you know it's great. They have just a wide variety of stuff. You know, depending on the power level, you can go. You might have to change. I think the only thing I've ever had to do is beef up the opponents just mm-hmm. a little bit, because as the game progresses, some of the adventures, if you've adventured a while, they're pretty easy unless you make some changes. But in general, you know, most of the adventures are like. Oh, there's two of these, you know, two or three of these mooks per player. That's, you know, they have like this built-in balancing thing. The only thing that ever gets tough is that there's only usually one, for lack of a better word, boss, someone who's something that's a wild card that you have mm-hmm. to deal with. But, you know, it's like, I love the fact that it's a little scary. I like the supernatural elements, you know. And there's so much you can still do with it. It's like, hey, you know... You want to go fight pirates? You can go fight pirates. You don't have to actually face supernatural threats. You know, you can go fight pirates. You can go fight, you know, slavers. You know, mm-hmm. you can go get to explore the new parts of the new world early on when there's only a few mm-hmm. basic settlements.
You can find out whatever happened to Raleigh.
I mean, yeah, actually, they have an adventure about that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think is that
could be fun here.
Or is it Roanoke?
So I got a question for you.
Yeah,
if you had to recommend a single media or movie that you needed them to watch before they played Solomon Kane, what would it be?
You know, funny you should ask because there's a Solomon Kane movie.
That makes it easy.
I mean, not that the movie is. Authentic or original, but it's not a bad movie. But, you know, I would say that. I would say things like, you know, as much as it's historically wrong in so many aspects, and it makes Native Americans, you know, it's that, there's that whole romanticization of Native Americans that happens. You know, the Last of the Mohicans is not a, I mean, it's way later in time period, but that's not a bad movie. There is the, hell, there's the, there's things like Plunkett and McLean, which is kind of a semi-comedy. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I don't think I actually have.
You know, even watching The Three Musketeers, even though it's set in a later time period, is not a bad, you know, is not bad. I mean, it's later, but you kind of can get some, you know, you can get some of the swashbuckling elements that you can possibly have. Almost any pirate movie is not a bad idea, you know. I don't know. It's weird. It's like those are the kind of things that you, there's all those elements possible. You know, maybe not so much the supernatural elements in some of those movies, but you have other bits and pieces. You never heard of Plunkett and McLean? Yeah. It had, what the fuck is the guy's name? He's a guy that, he plays Sherlock Holmes in that TV show Elementary.
Oh, right. Coverman? No.
John Lee Miller?
No, that's Sherlock. Sorry, I'm thinking of the other one.
John Lee Miller or John Miller, something like that. Is that his name? He was in freaking Hackers. He was married to Angelina Jolie.
Yes, yes. Here, okay. Well, fortunately, we have the internet, so let's find out. Johnny Lee Miller?
Yep, that's... I had...
I referred to kind of Bunker Cumberbatch, the rare Sherlock.
Right. So, but that Plunkett and McLean actually had Liv Tyler in it, too. It's a strange, funky movie. But it's fun to watch. I recommend it just for its... I wouldn't watch it seriously, but it's a fun movie just to watch. Him and the other guy that's in it, they end up becoming highwaymen.
Oh, wow.
You know, and like that's France. I think the setting's supposed to be in France. You know, they're highwaymen in France.
Oh, definitely.
So
I'm going to throw another movie which may or may not fit out there. Forgive me if you mentioned it before, but would Brotherhood of the Wolf work for a Solomon Kane type story?
I don't think I've seen that one.
Where you have a problem in the 18th century where there's wolves coming out and they're coming out of weird situations here, and apparently that's something stuck in my head.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that almost any... I mean, you take anything. You take, like, some of the... some of the earlier Hammer flicks. Hell, Captain Kronos would be, you could say, is a good example of kind of quasi... Solomon Kane dish. That would actually be a good movie to watch. You ever see that one? It's an old.
Yes, Hammer. Actually, I think I have.
It's an old.
It's been a while though.
It's an old Hammer film. Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. Yeah. When the hell was this made? It had to be the 60s or something like that. 74. Nope, that's a different movie. Where the hell's the year on here?
Okay.
74. Yeah, 74. It's listed as adventure, horror, mystery.
Oh, wow.
You know, and, you know, I mean, let's face it. You know, has the guy that plays Kronos is a German actor. And then the one hot chick, of course, was Carolyn Monroe.
Nice.
You know.
Hey, knockoffs are how you keep yourself going sometimes.
You know, and it's like, he had like, you know, and Kronos had like this sidekick guy who was like the brains, or the real brains of the operation. It's a fun movie just to watch. I mean, it's, you know, I wouldn't say it's super serious, but I think it's a fun movie to watch. And I think, let's see, what do they rate this on? People give, IMDb lists it as 6.6. I would list it maybe as a 7.5. A little higher than that myself.
Okay. Well, again, you'd be surprised what you could forgive on a movie if it's entertaining.
Yeah. So, you know, but, you know, so I you know, so that, so there are some ones that I would say would be good choices for a Solomon Kane setting, you know, feel, you know, but again, and so I guess that's my personal favorite. I do like Savage Worlds for other things. It kind of depends. I like the idea of Weird Wars 2 using the Savage World system. I just can't run it. I have a problem with, you know, how much do you deviate from history at that point? Because one of the things
at that point, you might as well be grabbing BJ Blazkowicz and Indiana Jones are going crazy.
Right. Because one of the nice things about Solomon Kane is that at a certain level, you don't really affect history as we know it. No matter what you do, you don't really affect the time.
You're in an area that was, Age of Enlightenment, paradoxically, was one of the most superstitious eras in the universe, during history.
Right.
Because they had something to compare it to, and a lot of people didn't like the fact that the rules were changing and they didn't like it.
Yeah. So.
And that is pitch perfect for an adventuring environment, because you're basically bouncing between the line of the old supernatural and the new Enlightenment era.
Yeah. And it's like people, it's great. I mean, like I said, I that's why I like about the setting is I think there's a lot of adventure opportunities. And because the way the book is, you don't really need to know everything. You just need to know enough to fake it.
And exactly.
I think that's the other thing in gaming people forget. It's like, I'm never going to say I'm an expert in Japanese culture. As long as I know enough to get by and as long as the players are having fun, the Japanese culture is just going to have to forgive me if I get things wrong.
Well, here's the thing. If you're playing with your buddies and you're having fun, and nobody's actually getting hurt in the real world, it doesn't really matter. You're not going to know which fork is supposed to use with which dish.
Yeah.
And it's only if your group has an agreement to go up, into a cultural diaspora that it's going to matter.
Right. And I think this is where... This is what I tell people about any game, is most games, nobody wants to have to be the so-called super subject matter expert just to play. You don't want to become a super, subject matter expert on something just to play. And there is a certain level of detail that the players don't give a shit about.
Often, we're in the middle of a weird environment. Where's my target and what's my gun or sword or magical spell or what have you?
Well, it's not that.
Because ultimately it's going to be tailored towards the players and what they want to, what sort of fun they want to get out of there.
Right. So it's that kind of thing. But everyone I've ever played Solomon Kane with has loved it. It's like, because I think it, at least, I mean, there are bits and pieces of it in a lot of other games, but I think overall it is a very unique setting. I think it's, it's ripe for adventurers. It's like the players don't have to be perfect people, but they have to be on the side of good.
Yeah.
And
what gives you a throughput to work with, because you know which line, where the morality line is, which means that when inevitably your group of players asks, can we play an evil campaign? You can honestly say no.
Yeah, it doesn't fit.
Because you already have your basic,
Yeah.
You know what's on the tin. Here's what we're trying to do, and it might help cut down communication issues.
Yeah. The whole premise I don't think everyone necessarily would have to have this, but one of the premises is that the way they set it up is that most of the players are supposed to have had some sort of tie-in or run-in with Solomon Kane himself. They were a bad guy and he just spared them for some reason, or they were slaves somewhere and he happened to free them, or any number of other things, And it's like, so in a weird way, the players have a unity through Solomon Kane for their group, because they've all have had to interact with him or had, something ties each one of them to Solomon Kane. So the fact is that he becomes the bind between all of them.
Makes perfect sense to me.
So,
if you're playing the game with Steam on the tin, this is the equivalent of your one unique thing.
Yeah.
How do you know Solomon Kane, and how did it bring you to this point in the story?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is that even without that, if you played the plot point campaign, there's God, I forget his name. His name escapes me. He's like in the actual Solomon Kane books, he's like a ally of Solomon Kane. He's like this African witch doctor. And he actually comes to the players in the plot point campaign. He comes to the players in some sort in their dreams to set them on their first adventure. So in some ways, even without Solomon Kane tying them together, the fact that these, you know, that in that plot point campaign, all the players are also bound by this shared dream. And the nice thing is that players can come and go because, you know, new players can be contacted via this dream method. It almost includes this method to insert new players.
I like that. That's actually a really good way to springboard off into the situation.
Yeah. You know. So, anyway, that's it. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't other games, like I said, other Savage World games I don't mind, but to me, it itches that spot between fantasy and modern day where there's technology, but it's not high up. There's superstitions still. People are very superstitious. You know, religion has a place, whether you like it or not, you know?
Yeah, it's basically a completed world, which you can do a lot with.
Right. And you can at least have some you can use some historical elements if you want. And, you know, you can do shipboard actions. I mean, let's face it, who doesn't want to, you know, shoot a few cannons off?
Never has been the power of a good, you know, pirate ship.
Yeah.
You know, and if you want to make it historically based, you can. If you don't, you don't have to. Right. You can literally land anywhere on the planet and ultimately say bad things are happening. What are you going to do about it?
Right. And I mean, it's nice to be able to go from Africa to South America to North America, you know. And I mean, honestly, you go places in the plot point campaign that technically nobody really has gone there yet, at least initially. But that's okay because it's a game. And, you know, it's no matter what happens, all the adventures you have don't really affect history.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh my
God. All the fun with none of the responsibilities.
Right. Unless you fail to save the world and then the world ends.
Well, these things happen.
So let's get on with your game, because I've just been sprouting about, Solomon Kane for a while now. And I know most of the listeners are like, yeah, we know Solomon Kane. Yeah. And it's weird because I expected them to release a new edition at some point. I really do. I hope they do. I don't know if they can. I don't know if they still have the license for that. I mean, they still sell Solomon Kane, and they still sell the supplement. Which, again, like I said, someone there really loved that topic, because I will tell you now that I think for Pinnacle, I think Solomon Kane has the most adventures than any setting they have written.
I did not know that. That's amazing.
Well, think about it. I told you. The core rulebook has like 30 or so plus adventures, and then they have another book that has another 30 or 40.
Yeah.
You know, nothing.
So, in short, because it's really easy to set up a plot line, it's literally you can whip one out, you got a whole bunch ready to go in a binder, you can pull one out just as you need it.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what's great. And you can create some of your own stuff in the meantime. It's like, you know, I'm a little slow. Where are they? Oh, they're in Europe. Have I run this one in Europe? Do I want to run this one in Europe? It's like, yeah, okay, go. So,
exactly.
You know, I mean, the only other setting I could think of that I don't think they did it for, but I think has quite a few. I want to say Flash Gordon had quite a few little adventures, or they just had a lot of supplements. I can't remember. I haven't looked through my stuff in a while. But I mean, that's the other game.
Well, yeah.
That's the other game system that they really love. The only reason I did not mention Flash Gordon as my personal, because I have not played it. You know.
You know, you just answered one of my questions I was going to bring up later. Favorite game you've never played? I think you just answered your own question.
It would have to be Flash Gordon, because I like the idea. I love the old serials, the old action serials, you know? So, and let's face it,
dude,
as bad as it was, I don't know anyone that doesn't get a little chuckle out of the old Flash Gordon movie.
I'm not going to disagree with you there.
So
I supported the Kickstarter for a reason, because honestly, I really want to try it. So, yeah. I'll include that there. Okay, well, for my own favorite RPG and why, I'm going to tell you the truth. I usually fall in love with worlds over mechanics, because a good world, like, good mechanics make it run so you don't grumble at each other.
Right.
A fantastic world makes you fall in love with it, and it makes you want to produce there.
Well,
I'm going to try to bring up something I don't know if I've brought up before. Red Star. Red Star is one of the most unique environments I've ever seen. And I've seen a lot of environments. It takes place in Russia, or their version of Russia, in the 90s or so in their version, as the country is kind of falling apart because of the transformation of everything here. And magic exists, but it's regulated into protocols because, of course, they're good, you know, materialists in how they work with stuff here. And the best way to describe it is, what if you were fighting for the last remains of the Iron Curtain and then you found out you don't want to? Yeah. So you got concepts like Hailers, which are basically the Russian, you know, the Red Guard, if they were bred, you know, basically meant to be tall and telekinetic. And they're armed with these giant poles that are basically known as the Hook, which basically act as a combination of telekinetic machine gun, flamethrower, and so forth. One of the ways you can is you might end up as a essentially criminal that's forced to the front lines in one of their massive battles and so forth, because they just finished going through the analog of Afghanistan, where they've been kind of humbled to some degree because of it, even though they have better toys, and some of the magic is actually more effective in that world, that area there. Plus, they also somehow managed to throw in a Russian romantic story where one of the characters ended up dying and coming back from the astral to basically act like the equivalent of Baba Yaga.
Huh.
And it's just gonzo as all hell. I don't even know if I'm giving him much credit.
Oh, by the way, speaking of Baba Yaga, you can in one of the Solomon Kane's adventures, I think technically you can actually meet her.
Oh, wow.
You know, I mean, that's
She gets around.
Yeah, you can go meet Dracula, you can meet her, you can meet some other creatures. Great. So, okay, I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, no worries, man. So, the best way to describe the actual experience is I managed, because I was trying to get a better understanding of this world, so I picked up the PlayStation 2 game that's associated with this. It was like one of the last things ever produced on a PS2. It is without a doubt one of the hardest games I've ever played that I haven't complained about the controls. It's a cross between a beat-em-up, but as soon as you fight the boss, it becomes, you're basically playing a, do you know what a bullet hell is?
Mm-hmm.
One of those games, like 1941, those old video games where you basically have a little ship around you firing, there's hundreds of bullets around you.
Okay.
Now imagine that as playing by a player, and you're fighting a industrial war machine in order to do so. And that's kind of the best way to describe it there. Heavy industrial techno magic crossed with the need to liberate a people and figure out what their destiny leads. And I'm not even read enough Russian folklore, here and there, but it's interesting seeing this point in transition as far as the point in time. And because it takes place in a fictional world, you can just basically draw in as much as you want, as much as you don't want. So I would say it's probably the most unique world on my list, but ultimately, I could mention a lot of worlds, and surprisingly, quite a few of them are created by GURPS. What a surprise!
Well, let's talk GURPS for just a second, because one of the things that they did have going for it, they had a ton of setting books. At one time, it didn't matter whether or not you like GURPS or not; you would buy the setting books just for the source material.
They did their homework, And then they did other homework, because if they got a license for a novel and book, they would explain it to death. I still have a copy of Conan over there, which basically is still one of the better explanations of the world, what material was used, the tales that were made after the fact, and how they interconnect with each other, the experience of Lovecraft. That's where I first learned about the Lovecraft connection with Conan. But if I had to say a single GURPS book to mention, I would have to say Illuminati. I knew nothing about the Illuminati until I picked up the GURPS book. Or the idea of secret conspiracies and so forth. Like, there's been other games that have probably done a better job since then. But it was... Okay, do you remember how the original first edition Dungeons & Dragons had all those stupid little comics in between the stories, where they would do a serious picture, and then every so often they would have the equivalent of one of those Far Side comics.
Right.
They'd have a one-panel comic.
Right.
GURPS Illuminati is filled with those things. Like, it shows a guy tinkering with a mind control device that says, I think I've developed a device that can help me find an honest man, but we're politicians. What the hell will we do with it?
Yeah.
And other stuff, like they had this one wizard that kept showing up, and basically he said one of my favorite lines of all time. I got a theory, but the only way to prove it is to destroy the universe. But it's a really neat theory. And it just talks about stuff and these weird conspiracies and so forth, and how, well, the original GURPS Illuminati actually only, you know, the original Illuminati only lasted for, what, 10 years? But then they mention other stuff like the Knights Templar and all this stuff, and you can basically go down that conspiracy rabbit hole corner. And this is before we ended up, I don't know, creating our own conspiracies, for lack of a better term.
I don't know why, but all of a sudden, you ever see I Married an Axe Murderer?
Yes, actually, I have.
I don't know why, but all of a sudden, I was just thinking of Mike Myers' character who was playing, you know, Mike Myers' character playing Mike Myers' character's father.
Oh, yes, and he had, like, that heavy-duty Scottish accent that would eventually sound like Shrek.
Right.
Even though it was actually before it.
And he was talking about the Pentaveret. You know? You know, exactly. who's in the Pentaveret, you know? You know, the Rothschilds, the Queen, the Colonel before he went tits up. You know, it's just like...
Well, dude, a conspiracy is fun,
you know,
when it's fictional.
And he's talking about all these things, and they have, like, biannual meetings at a place called The Meadows.
Well, you can subvert it with just about any group. Like, you find out the secret society is actually just a bunch of old men hanging out with each other. Like, one of my favorite has always been the Stonecutter Simpsons episode where they pretend to be this ultra-secret society, but basically it's a glorified frat party.
I think that's the one where it's like the chief of police gives Homer the number 912. That's what you want to call, you know, if something really happens. You know, they don't respond to 911 calls, but if you dial 912, you know.
Exactly.
And like, if memory serves me, that's the episode that they get so fed up with him, they start another society that he can't be a member of.
Yeah, the No Homers Allowed Club.
Exactly.
And again, like, I know it's been played out and probably had some horrific consequences in the grand scheme of things, but at that point, I knew absolutely nothing about the Men in Black.
Mm.
And this was like at least 10 years before the Will Smith movie when they presented him in a positive light. Until then, that was literally the first time they were ever presented positively. Instead, they were these creepy guys in suits that basically went around making sure he didn't reveal the conspiracy. The helicopters, the whole nine yards. And I don't know. It was just... It's one of those times where you find, and it's also one of the reasons I think the great Kenneth Haidt was the one that wrote it, a good chunk of it, or at least got influenced by it. And I love crazy bits of reality that can be gamified is the best way to describe it. Because you just go down that rabbit hole and see where it leads.
Well, you know, it's like I always, you know, there's always those great stories of, you know, or even movies. I always take, like, you know, for lack of a better thing, freaking Galaxy Quest. You know, the actors end up, you know, that are portraying characters end up actually in a situation where they kind of have to act like their characters and be their characters. Yeah. Or, you know, there's the old Joel Rosenberg, you know, God, what the hell is the Guardians of the Flame series, where, you know, you know, that's the classic, oh, we're a bunch of D&D gamers without actually playing D&D. And we got transported to this world that we've been gaming in. And now we do our thing.
Exactly.
You know.
That's really funny.
That's that little weird wish fulfillment, you know.
Right.
So.
Well, that's part of the... Sorry, I had a train of thought, but I think I've lost it here. So I will... Well, Jeff, what's the next one on your list that you want to rant about?
Oh, I would have to say if I had a second choice, again, I could not run this, but probably my next favorite game, Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
And for nothing else, but I think there's a pattern here. I sometimes like stuff that's a little weird to play, you know, has like the unspeakables, you know, a little bit of horror thrown in. And I mean, it's not to be bad, but it's like, you know, Call of Cthulhu is one of those games where you never really expect to live as a player.
No. That one you know where you're up against.
But
unlike a lot of games, it's not a wish fulfillment fantasy. It's a...
Right.
Survival.
Right.
I might live through this experience and be only partially insane.
Yeah. You know.
Because it's based on the premise that, no, you're some two-bit twit who got his head stuck in something he probably shouldn't have known anything in the first place.
Well, and you know, it's, I think Call of Cthulhu is fun because I have to say, almost any time I've ever played, it's always like 1930s is a good favorite. You know, pre-World War II, between World War I, World War II is always a favorite. Do a little Victorian sometimes. It's like either 20s or the 30s are pretty much the hot spots for most of the groups that I've ever played.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it was such a period of change that it was a chance to see beyond. A lot of power structures were destroyed during World War I. So it was a lot of optimism and new changes here.
Right. And then
and
you take the 1930s.
Once the optimism is broken because of the 30s.
Yeah.
It's, well, when you've got, you know, what's the old saying goes? You don't start a revolution when you have nothing. You start it when you have something and you lose it. And you lost the prosperity of the 20s. After the horror of the, you know, World War I.
Right.
And when you've been pushed into a corner, you will do things you probably never believed before. And what a better time for some weird supernatural intelligence from beyond the pale to go, meh.
Yeah, but I mean, it's fun. I mean, we've played all kinds of characters, you know, everything from the classical, I'm like this, you know, college professor who studied a little bit of the occult to, you know, I'm a hobo who's lived off, you know, I'm a hobo traveling the rails. And because I've been so many places, I just know shit. And I've seen the unknowable.
Exactly.
You know.
And then you end up in Hoboken just in time to watch the Night of the Ritual, which you already see is happening here. And you find out one of the hobo signs is actually the Elder Sign.
Right. You know, that kind of stuff. So, but you know, and I mean, the rule set for Call of Cthulhu is fairly simple. I mean, it uses the, what is it? The I forget what the hell they call it. BTRC? Is that right?
Yeah, the basic role-playing system. Yeah. The one that was used for RuneQuest and all that. And,
RuneQuest, you know, ElfQuest, you know, all those other games. Stormbringer. Superhero 2044.
Yeah.
Which...
And it's kind of amazing how much... Well, literally, you could argue that it was the first generic system just because of how old it is. And how many times they tried using in different systems and so forth.
It probably is. I would say that it is. I would say that there is a definite argument for that. I would probably list that as probably one of the oldest generic eyes systems just because they used it in everything.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yet paradoxically, Call of Cthulhu sticks out because it isn't a generic system. They add the insanity checks. They get the feel here. It's a feeling of disempowerment, not empowerment, in the situation here.
Well, I think that's what makes that game unique, you know? So, you know, there's actually an old running joke. You know, Call of Cthulhu, where the longest-lived characters have the highest movement rates.
Fun fact.
So,
if you ever get in a Call of Cthulhu campaign, see if you have a toboggan.
You know, but I mean, I've just played a lot of games, and I think definitely in Call of Cthulhu, because you know your player's going to die, I hate to say it, there's like this need to do a little more role-playing.
Yeah.
You know, to come up with a backstory, and it's weird. It's like you're not going overbound in your backstory. You're not like, I'm going to be the king of, you know, France or something. You know, there's nothing weird. It's just like, oh, I'm this rich guy, and... You know, I'm just a dilettante or something. Or like I said, you're, you know, hey, I was, you know, my hobo character was in, you know, the First World War. You know, and when he came back from the war, you know, he fell on hard times and he was a hobo, which explains some of his skills. You know, that kind of thing.
So, well, a Call of Cthulhu campaign is literally that one bad day that we have all... Because I can't think of anything worse than running into anything from beyond the pale.
Right, exactly.
Especially if your world's supposed to be normal.
Oh, no. So, all right. So that's my second, game that I would have to say. Those, and it's weird how closely related they are in a way.
Well, often the reason you attach to a game is because it draws on a hidden aspect that you kind of want to explore.
Well, I think a lot of
or feeling or mentality you were having during the time when you kind of imprinted on it, for lack of a better term.
I think what it is for me is I don't know anyone who's played Call of Cthulhu and played Solomon Kane that just didn't have fun. I played a lot of other games where people just did not have fun for whatever reason. And I definitely think with both those games, people are willing to suspend disbelief just a little bit more than some of the other games I've played. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's it. It's like, you know, just I think it's almost that level of fantastic. It's just that certain level of fantastic. It's not too fantastic. It has a certain ground of reality. And then there's just this little difference that's just out there. And I think that's what gets me. You know, I think it's like I love playing fantasy games. But at a certain point, I'm just like, everyone's a fucking wizard. Everyone, you know, it's like at a certain point, you're just like, there's way too much magic. Everyone has these magic items. Why? You know, where, you know, Call of Cthulhu or even, you know, even Solomon Kane, you're lucky to have some sort of weird mystic artifact. And even then, you're just like,
yeah. And nine times out of ten in Call of Cthulhu, you don't want it.
I don't want to read the book. You got to read the book to get the clue. Fuck.
Well, I liked my sanity while I had it.
Yeah.
And I think you got a point there. Like, I think what it comes down to for Call of Cthulhu is, well, I'm going to say it again, it's a different experience.
Yeah. And they let's face it, they have a lot of material out there. They've done a lot of work. I mean, how many I know for a fact that we've had lots of Kickstarters where people would not necessarily reprinting the adventures, but reprinting or creating brand new, like, playing aids for them. High quality ones too, and that
Call of Cthulhu seems to have the greatest bunch of Kickstarters when it comes to accessories.
Yeah, you know,
game I've ever seen has ever been as successful in our Kickstarter experience. Whether it's a wood box, whether it's a funny hat, whether it's pieces of cardboard.
Yeah,
it seems like it can do no wrong if you get the right group.
I don't know if it can do any wrong, but it has a very strong following in that market because I think there's a certain level of theatrics attached to it.
Well,
almost.
I think in some ways you could argue that, among other things, Call of Cthulhu was one of the first LARPs. Because it always seems to have that theatrical backdrop when it comes down to it there.
I think it's the closest that I've come to doing a LARP without being in a LARP.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not gonna lie. I can never do a LARP. I can never be in a LARP. That's just not my thing.
That's fair.
But I don't mind a little bit of acting. I don't mind a little bit of this and that. And some games make it easier than others. And I think Call of Cthulhu, by its just nature of, you know, your character's not going to grow crazy anyway. Mm-hmm. In skills.
Well, so, there's a definite location. You're not, you know.
Right, and you're not, you know. I don't know. There's. And you know, you might not even be right, but it's just fun. You know, I think it's fun to be able to imagine these people, and I think that's what it is. I think a lot of people that I know that play Call of Cthulhu, they like to come up with these fun characters to play, and that brings a lot to the game. You know, let's face it, you play D&D, you know, there's character classes. I need a fighter, we need a thief, we need a wizard, we need a cleric. For lack of, you know.
Yeah, more often than not, you're playing archetypes of some sort.
Right. Where there are archetypes, sort of, in Call of Cthulhu, but not really. You kind of create your own. You know, I mean, a lot of it's based on your background, you know, of course, because you have different backgrounds. And I think, too, there was that whole level, you know, especially with Call of Cthulhu, there's this whole level of randomness. And you just make a character out of this random mess. And it's funny.
Yeah.
You know, people, I want to create this character like this. You know, that's not fun. I actually say, that's what I mean, this is why I'm going to talk about my third one right now, which is Traveler.
Okay, that's fair.
Just because Traveler's my third favorite game to play. The problem is I don't know what edition I'd ever want to play it in today. That's the only problem.
Yeah.
But you take Classic Traveler. The best thing about Classic Traveler is just random character generation. Everything about your character is random. Between your skills, to your attributes, to how long you served in the service. And you just make a character off of that. You just go with it. Mm-hmm. And I know people like, I don't like that. I have this vision for my character. Fuck your vision. Use your imagination.
Yeah. Why would this Congratulations. Character... You watched out of the Academy. Deal with it.
You know, but I'm just saying, it's like, use your imagination. Figure out why this what makes this particular character tick. Why did he only serve one term in any service? You have only a couple of skills. Why are you actually adventuring with the fact that you have, like, no skills? What's this guy's story? That's more interesting to me than having, you know, having the Pathfinder character with just the right feats to defeat just about everything that I touch with my little finger. That's not interesting.
No.
You know, I'm going to say something about creativity that I know there are people that are going to argue with me on this one. But I believe sometimes when you're limited in what you can choose to do, you get more creative.
I'm going to completely agree with you in that situation here. Because of one personal experience just recently. We just finished playing a Marvel Fast Rip system where we had to roll our characters randomly. And it's kind of fun trying to adapt to the random action. You know, your power set, because you don't know what you're going to get. I got stupidly lucky. I came up with a silly concept and it seemed to work quite well. And the campaign was definitely... could best be described as where the GM took Thanos, used the Infinity Gauntlet to break copyright.
That's okay.
And stuff like that is what keeps you going, like gets you into a weird situation, and then you go from there. And you're right. You know, I think we've said it many a time on this show, but I'll say it again. The experience is more important than the actual mechanics in most situations here. You're not going to remember when you killed your 1,000th orc unless you're really pedantic. But you will remember the day that your hobo showed up with a shotgun in front of a bunch of Shoggoth. Whether you lived or died, well, that's part of the story.
Or the player next to you went mad at the Mountains of Madness and, you know, shot a couple people with a high-powered rifle, you know?
Exactly.
That sort of thing.
And again, that's experiences is why we game. I'll throw one last one here. I'll try to do it relatively quick. I'm going to bring up one that's really weird, but I think it's because it's so meta. Even though I usually like a fluffier system, I really like Hackmaster.
Okay.
I like the whole... let me rephrase that. It's a horribly complex game. It should not be on my list for the most part when it comes to systems here. If anything, it's a parody of a game. But that's why I like it. Because it's very much nostalgia written in satire. Because all these overly contrived tables, I remember the first time around. I remember these horrible things. Plus, on top of that, I was a diehard fan of Knights of the Dinner Table. I still collect the Blaze subscription. Nice. And it's fun taking concepts and putting them on their head. Like the Dark Elves. Whatever happened to the ones that didn't go get driven underground? Hackmaster has an answer for that. They basically became wood elves that think that everybody else are a bunch of ninnies. Or, you know, like, you gotta play the mentality, the Hackmaster, everything's gonna try to kill you mentality in the game. But it's got a certain charm to play a game in it, because especially if you've had experience with some of the ones, like, their version of Keep on the Borderlands is called Little Keep of the Borderlands. Because everything is a parody of some sort. And if you look, I have the entire 8 volumes of the original Hackmaster, which they do when they had first and second editions licensed as well. And yeah, some are little ripoffs of old monsters, and some are literal responses to old monsters. You know, it would not be... It's one of those Catch-22s. It's not a monster manual I would ever make, because there's problems with it. But dang it, is the one I enjoy.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. And plus, it's kind of fun taking, you know, filling niches that should have existed. Or what if Gary Gygax would have had D&D for another 10 years? As opposed to the transition when he got kicked out of the company around the mid-80s. We have an answer now, and it was created by Dave Kentzer and Jolly Blackburn. But I think that's good enough for now, unless there's anything else you guys want to bring up.
No, I think that's it. Okay, normally at this point we would have our Kickstarters, but due to some technical issues, our whole segment of Kickstarters got kind of screwed up in the audio recording. So I will have the list of Kickstarters that are kind of newish in the show notes for this go-around. However, that does bring me to probably the little bit of news that you may or may not want to hear. And that is that our next episode of RPG Circus, which will happen roughly in about 2 weeks, will be the last episode of RPG Circus that we will be having. It has been a fun 9.5+ years. However, I feel that I'm getting a little repetitive, and we will talk more about this in the next episode as a kind of farewell. I'm currently planning on having several of the former co-hosts come on, and hopefully it's a good time for everybody. And with that, we will see you for the last episode in just about 2 weeks. RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.